Yashodananda, ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। So, continuing with chapter 18 of Srimad Bhagavad Gita as it is, text number 19. We read past that, but we actually didn't cover more than a verse last time. Yeah. Okay, so that's page 810, if you have the same type of book. Chapter 18, text 19. Jnanam karma cha karta cha Tridhaiva guna bhedatah Prochyate guna sankhyane Yathavat shrinutanyapi. According to the three different modes of material nature, there are three kinds of knowledge, action, and perform of action. Now hear of them from me. Sarva bhuteshu yenaikam bhavam avyayamikshate avibhaktam vibhakteshu tajjnanam vidhi sattvikam. That knowledge by which one undivided spiritual nature is seen in all living entities, though they are divided into innumerable forms, you should understand to be in the mode of goodness. Pritaktvena tu yajjnanam nana bhavan prithagvidhan veti sarveshu bhuteshu tajjnanam vidhi rajasam. That knowledge by which one sees that in every different body there is a different type of living entity, you should understand to be in the mode of passion. Yattu kritsna vadekasmin karye karye saktam mahaitukam atatvartha vadalpancha tattamasam mudahritam. And that knowledge by which one is attached to one kind of work as the all in all, without knowledge of the truth, and which is very meager, is said to be in the mode of darkness. Niyatam sangarahitam araga dveshata kritam aphala prepsuna karma yattat sattvikam uchyate. That action which is regulated and which is performed without attachment, without love or hatred, and without desire for fruitive results, is said to be in the mode of goodness. Yattu kame psuna karma sahankarena vapuna kriyate bahulayasam tadrajasamudahritam. But action performed with great effort by one seeking to gratify his desires and enacted from a sense of false ego is called action in the mode of passion. And one more. Anubandham kshayam himsam anapekshyatcha paurusham mohadarabhyate karma yattat tamasamuchyate. That action performed in illusion, in disregard of scriptural injunctions, and without concern for future bondage or for violence or distress caused to others, is said to be in the mode of ignorance. Om jnanati mirandhasya jnananjana shalakaya chakshurunmelitam jena tasmai shri gurave namaha mukam karoti vachalam pangum langhayate girim yat kripatamaham vande shri gurum dinataranam paramananda madhavam. So today we actually begin the large section in the 18th chapter, which is dedicated to describing different things in the three modes of material nature. So we know, of course, that in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna has already described the divisions of the three modes of material nature, right? I think it started in chapter 14, which is called the three modes of nature, and then chapter 17, is it? Yeah. Chapter 17, the divisions of faith. So he's already at length described the different things in the three modes of material nature. Right? We've gone through charity in the three modes of nature, and food in the three modes of material nature, and all kinds of things. So the chapter 18, once again, is kind of more of a recap than a summary than a really new section of Bhagavad Gita. Srila Prabhupada says in the first verse, the purport to the first verse of this chapter, that really the Bhagavad Gita has ended by the end of chapter 17. Krishna has pretty much said everything he wants to say. There's not much new here, but there's a summary. Like at the end of any good book, there's a summary, there's a recap, and finally there's Krishna's major conclusion at the end. So this section here is, we'll be dealing for quite a few verses now. In fact, nearly to the end of the chapter, with with the three modes of material nature and duties and different things associated with the three modes of material nature. And today we begin with something very basic. Krishna says he's going to talk about three things first: knowledge, jnanam, action, karma, and the performer of action, karta. These three things Krishna is going to say what they are in the different three modes of material nature. And today we covered two: knowledge and action, jnana and karma. Now, this knowledge, this question of knowledge is very, knowledge in three modes of material nature is very nice, it's very important, because in some sense, knowledge is the foundation of everything we do, what we know, how we think. Last week, if you remember, in the verse, we talked about how the motivation for performing action is knowledge, basically, right? The knowledge, the knower, and the object of knowledge. Jnanam, jnayam, and the jnata, or the knower. These three things put together motivate or provide the impetus for action. So before we talk about action in the three modes of material nature, Krishna naturally, he wants to talk about knowledge in the three modes of material nature. So it's a very kind of a logical progression that's going on. He's not being haphazard here. And then once you talk about action, then also the performer of action, or the karta. So each one of the different aspects is being discussed. We've been talking about these three things in detail. Now Krishna wants to classify it so that we can determine where we're at and where we want to be. Now, the nice thing about such classification in the Bhagavad Gita is you notice that basically kind of no one's really left out of the Vedic philosophy. No one's left out of the Bhagavad Gita. Means everyone's somehow or other classified, categorized. Even those who are at the lowest platform of existence get a place here. They're in the mode of ignorance. And so the knowledge of Bhagavad Gita in that way becomes all-encompassing. Every level of creation can be seen in Bhagavad Gita. And therefore, each one of us, no matter where we're at in the evolution of consciousness, we can find ourselves in Bhagavad Gita. We can say, this is where I'm at when it comes to my knowledge. This is where I'm at when it comes to my action. Here's where I'm at when it comes to my food or my charity or the sacrifices I perform or my mentality or whatever it might be. I can find myself in Bhagavad Gita. And what that means is when you can find yourself, then you can figure out how to progress. Because Krishna, besides giving the classification system, also gives a system of progression. So in some sense, if you want to perform some kind of an activity, suppose you want to eat meat, for example, then yeah, that's fine. Krishna also talks about that. But you have to be satisfied living in the mode of ignorance. Right? This is where you'll be. And therefore, we shouldn't be surprised if we experience some of the symptoms of the mode of ignorance, right? Which is sloth and suffering and lethargy and a dull mind. And if we experience those symptoms, or experience the symptoms of the mode of passion, which is misery and pain and disease and stuff like that, then we shouldn't be surprised, right? In other words, we can find ourselves. Some people say, even in the Vedic system, people eat meat. Yes, that's true. Of course they do, but here's where you're at, right? So it becomes a question of finding oneself and deciding where I want to be, what my goal is. Right? So if our goal is to be in the mode of goodness, then we can go through and say, okay, in every aspect of my life, here's how I have to improve myself. Here's the standard to which I have to reach. And then I can expect this kind of a result. I can expect happiness, I can expect peacefulness, satisfaction, a long life, all these good qualities, concentration, so forth. So, first thing is knowledge. Krishna's talking about here. Let's start at the bottom rather than the top. Work our way up. It's a positive way to go. Krishna says, knowledge in the mode of ignorance is that knowledge by which one is attached to one kind of work as the all-in-all, kritsnavad ekasmin. Without knowledge of the truth, and which is very meager, is said to be in the mode of darkness. Let's read the purport for this verse. by Srila Prabhupada. The knowledge of the common man is always in the mode of darkness or ignorance, because every living entity in conditional life is born in the mode of ignorance. One who does not develop knowledge through the authorities or scriptural injunctions has knowledge that is limited to the body. He is not concerned about acting in terms of the directions of scripture. For him, God is money, and knowledge means the satisfaction of bodily demands. Such knowledge has no connection with the absolute truth. It is more or less like knowledge of the ordinary animals, the knowledge of eating, sleeping, defending, and mating. Such knowledge is described here as the product of the mode of darkness. In other words, knowledge concerning the spirit soul beyond this body is called knowledge in the mode of goodness, knowledge producing many theories and doctrines by dint of mundane logic and mental speculation is the product of the mode of passion, and knowledge concerned only with keeping the body comfortable is said to be in the mode of ignorance. So, mode of ignorance means basically knowledge that's centered or focused or absorbed in the body. When the sphere of our knowledge extends only as far as this physical body, right, then that knowledge is considered to be in the mode of ignorance. And of course, we can find unlimited numbers of examples of this in today's society. And possibly we can find good examples even in our own lives, right? At least periods of our life when we're absorbed in knowledge in the mode of ignorance. This knowledge is directed by one thing, which is sense pleasure, satisfying the body, comforts for the body. And there's always a certain section of society which is always interested in, you know, how can I get a good place to sleep? How can I find a good mate? How can I, you know, find good food? How can I protect myself? And this is it. Right? Srila Prabhupada, he often complained that the so-called higher educational system of modern society is, you know, it's supposed to be cultivating knowledge, right? This is the purpose of higher education. You can look at the mottos of all the different universities, their statement is, right? Knowledge, illumination, you know, whatever it is, three words that epitomize their purpose. Knowledge is the goal. But Prabhupada used to always say, he used to be disappointed by their definition of knowledge, their understanding of knowledge. What does that knowledge mean? That these universities, these institutions of higher education prepare a person for only what? Simply how to satisfy the demands of the body, right? How to fill your belly for the rest of your life, how to find a good partner, how to do this. Just simply satisfying the needs of the body. This is what's known as education. There used to be a time not too long ago when higher education was about cultivating some higher values, higher understanding, cultivating a more refined individual. These institutions are called universities, right? University. Just think about the word university. Right? Its universities are meant to create a universal man, right? A universal human being, someone who's broad-minded, someone who has character, who has values, who can see inclusively, who can see equally, right? Someone who's mahatma. Right? This is the word in Sanskrit. Broad-minded, udara, university. Rather than someone who's simply absorbed in himself. Right? This was the distinctions, the idea. So professors try to instill in their students some sense of, a love for knowledge itself and the pursuit of knowledge as a goal in itself. Right? But more and more and more you find that such a goal is disappearing. Right? Universities are becoming more and more what? Yeah, microversities. Microversities, yeah.
Well, there's also the concept in university, the term liberal arts.
Yeah, yeah.
Liberal meaning also broad.
Yes, yes, good point.
Open to ideas. And because the political mindset, because universities are extremely political, one could argue this stems from the 60s because of so much social effects, but you can mark this in age. undermined the analytical thinking. It threatened the establishment.
Mm.
And so what the establishment worked on doing was eliminating the free thinkers, the liberal thinkers. So we actually put a clamp down on free thinking and universal thinking. And rather than doing something that helps free one from knowledge, freeing one from material things,
yeah.
It actually induces how to be engrossed in.
Right. It becomes limiting rather than liberating. Right? The point of liberal arts is a very good thing. You know, most universities, at least somewhere in their purpose statement, you know, still emphasize a liberal arts education, which means again a broad-minded, a universal education, something that you know prepares a person for the world rather than just you know whatever it might be. You know, so I mean that's and this is also the purpose of partly the purpose of something like tenure. In universities, right? The job of the teacher or the brahmana should be secure so that this facilitates free thinking. You're not dependent. It makes you less dependent on the whims of your employer, right? If you know that you're fixed in the position and you cannot be removed from that position. It's like, you know, if you start free thinking too much in a corporate situation, right, before you know it, your job's gone. You can't, you know, you have to stay within certain limits. But in the academic world, the idea is that you can think freely, right, in education. I think teachers, elementary school teachers, get tenure too in many states. And the idea is you should be able to teach and to think freely, right, in order to inculcate this broad-minded idea within students and expose them to things that they otherwise would not in whatever background they're coming from or wherever they're heading in life. But now, more and more, the educational system is becoming unabashedly about getting a job. Right? It used to be kind of covered up in some kind of a, you know, more broad-minded language. But now, more and more, you see in purpose statements of universities and their mission statements, they're kind of unashamedly saying, our goal is to prepare students for the job market. Especially if you look in you know non-humanities type disciplines, it becomes you know very very prominent. It's producing employees for Micron and HP, right? It's a little employee preparation factory. The big large corporations put in the money, and you basically get people who are tailor-made to work in their company. Yes? When you graduate, they provide the funding for the, you know, Micron lab, you know, and this library and HP this, and you know, and they get employees that just fit into the whole machine, right? So what it does is it makes people think in a narrow way, right? It forces the mind simply in terms of Ganapati Swami. He was saying once he was on BSU's campus distributing books, and He said, you know, I've been distributing books in college campuses all across America for the last 30 years now. And he says, I have to say, in all honesty, that college students today are much stupider than they were when I was going to college. And he said, because I've seen them over 30 years, you know, he meets these students one-on-one, face-to-face. And what he meant by stupider was not that they're unable to perform math problems or this or that, but intelligence in the sense of what Krishna is describing as intelligence or as knowledge. Right? That the ability to ask questions which define ourselves as human beings. What are these questions that define us as human beings? Not where is my next job, where is my food, but what? Who am I? What am I doing here? What's the purpose of life? Why am I suffering? How do I stop this suffering? How do I improve my condition? What happens to me after death? Right? These are questions which define ourselves as human beings. The animals cannot ask such questions. Birds don't go around going, you know, what's the purpose of my life? Why am I building this nest? You know, why am I laying the egg for the 15th time? It's not. The chicken in the coop never asked that question. I've been laying eggs for years now, you know, and I've never seen one chicken come out because this farmer comes and takes it away, right? What's the purpose of life? Why am I doing this? Why am I suffering? It never occurs to her, this question. Well, maybe it does, but at least they're not able to express it, right? So this defines us as human beings. But he said, today, if you ask the, said when we were going to college in the 60s, right, as Chandrapur was saying, right, when we were going to college at that time, said these were questions that we were asking on a day-to-day basis, right? We would discuss stuff like this. We would get together in groups and we'd talk about it. Philosophy classes were full, were jam-packed full. Religion classes were full, right? But these days, if you talk to a student on the campus, right, and you ask them, well, what are your questions? What type of questions do you ask? What are you concerned about? What are the answers you're going to get? Yeah, exactly. You know, just how does this work? How does that work? How do I get a job? How do I graduate quickly as possible? And if you ask them deeper questions, you know, what's the purpose of life? It's kind of like, why are you asking that? It's irrelevant, you know. What purpose does that have in asking such, you know, deep philosophical questions? Right. So that change has taken place. The education, the definition of education has changed. And the reason for that, there's another devotee in University of Florida who I was talking to, a disciple of Srila Prabhupada, very senior, again, from the 60s. And he says the reason for this, he said, I'll tell you why. He said, is a very simple reason. He says, in one word, it's the draft. Right? He said, in the 60s, we had to face the prospect of going out and dying, right? Fighting, and the possibility of getting killed. The Vietnam War was going on. There's protests happening all over America. University of Florida happened to be one of the hotbeds of this protest movement in that part of the country. And he was right there, so he was talking about it. And he said that element of fear, right, that uncertainty, that perhaps I might have to go, and just one in 100,000 people, you know, just one day, just boom, you're gone. You know, and all you get is a little marker on a grave. So that possibility forced us to ask questions like, what's the purpose of life? Why am I here? Why am I suffering? Right? It drove us to that point. So in some sense, that fear elevated, right? In times of fear, people go to the temple, they go to the church, they go to the mosque, they pray to God. They question deeper things of life. But today we're fortunate to be living in, I don't know if you can say that anymore, but at least, you know, it's less of a turmoil situation than it was in the 60s. And so people don't ask those kinds of questions so much anymore. So that intelligence, that level of education, that so-called knowledge has sunk down to the mode of ignorance, as Krishna is describing here. Where can I find enough to eat? Where can I find, a girlfriend, a boyfriend? Where can I find, a place to sleep, a house, shelter? And how can we shoot our enemies? How can we kill them?
One of the things too is that they have created a system. Everything is relative. You know, there isn't a truth. There isn't something specific. Everything is relative. So there's no sense worrying or thinking about it anymore.
Yeah.
It just depends.
Yes.
It's only true if you think so.
Yeah, it's true for you.
So they've undermined even the process of seeking.
Yeah, it's in academic terms that's called postmodernism. There's no grand explanation for anything. Right? There's no big explanation. There's no universal theory. It's all, like you're saying, all relative. Your world, my world, it's all relative. What you say is true for you. What I say is true for me. Right? And what that means is basically I can engage in my search for sense gratification, you can engage in your search for sense gratification. You don't get in my way and I won't get in your way. It's like that. And if we do get in each other's way, then well, you know, might makes right. So that's the mode of ignorance. Yeah.
Four basic things mentioned are eating, sleeping, dependent on waiting.
Right.
And then also the way to spiritualize, you know, eating, making, conceive Krishna, conceive children.
Right.
And defending these principles. But how does sleeping fit in? I mean, how are we
How do you make sleep as a transcendental activity? Prabhupada says you read Krishna book before you go to bed and drink a glass of hot milk, right? And then when you go to sleep, you'll dream about Krishna. Yeah, part? Part? Yes, very good, very good. Sing Namaste Narsingaya before you fall asleep. Right. Yeah, Chandrapur?
It's also to regulate.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, regulating sleep. Krishna says in Gita, yuktahara viharasi yukta cheshtasya kar. Yukta swapna avabhodasya. Your sleep is regulated. Yogo bhavati dukha. Then you can destroy all miseries through this kind of regulated practice, right? So by regulating it, yes.
And also, I think thinking of people going to sleep, how did you accomplish in the day?
Yes, yes.
Did you, because even if sometimes you come to spiritual world,
yeah.
So you are not where you should be. You're still thinking in the narrow mind. So have you been softened?
Right.
Have you had improved a step further?
Yeah. What have I done today to please Krishna? Right? What have I done today to serve Krishna? What have I done today to serve God? A day that goes by without pleasing Krishna in some form, right? That day is worthless. It's useless. Yeah.
Question I have is, how do you know have you pleased Krishna today or not?
How do you know if you've pleased Krishna today? Yeah, Chandrapur.
A good example would be this ends. An hour and a half or so, and you go home and you spend time listening and hearing about activities of Krishna philosophy on these four principles, and you reflect on it. Just like yesterday, we were reflecting on what we discussed in Bhagavatam. So actually, Krishna is satisfied because he's in the center of our thoughts, and he says, always think of it. And this is the way to do it.
Okay. So, I mean, yeah. Basically, I mean, kind of generally speaking, you can know if you satisfy Krishna if you follow Krishna's instructions. Right? Krishna's given us a kind of a formula as to how he would like us to live our life, he would like us to spend our day. And if we follow those instructions, right, then we can be assured that Krishna will be pleased. Now, the follow-up question is, okay, how do we figure out what those instructions are? How do we figure out whether we follow those instructions or not? And that kind of tailor-made or personal application of Krishna's instructions, that's where the spiritual master, the guru, comes in. Right? It is the role of the guru to be the via media, the transparent via media between Krishna and us as aspirants in devotional service. So the guru is able to say, okay, Krishna is saying in Bhagavad Gita, do like this. How you should apply that in your own life is like this. So if we're able to follow the instructions of guru, which are in accord with the instructions of Krishna, then we can be fairly certain that Krishna is happy. We can be rest assured. So it's a day-to-day process though. Day-to-day, how can I please the spiritual master? How can I please Krishna? We sing every morning in the Gurvashtakam prayers. Yasya prasadad bhagavat prasado, yasya prasadan nagati kutopi. Yasya prasadad bhagavat prasado. He by whose mercy, when he is satisfied, Krishna is satisfied. And when he is not satisfied, yasya aprasada nagati kutopi. There is no destination, no recourse, no refuge whatsoever. To that spiritual master I offer my obeisances.
That question ties back to sometimes you are in a location or a place where you do not have spiritual master, access to a spiritual master,
right.
And you are stuck, and you have other people. You are caught in that situation. How do you know that you are doing in the right direction or not?
Okay, so two things. First of all, we have to make an endeavor to seek out a spiritual master, and when we are sincere. If we're truly sincere in following Krishna's instructions, then Krishna will send us the right spiritual master who is appropriate to our time and our situation. Right? So with that sincere desire, with that desire to seek out the spiritual master Krishna will send. regardless of what location we're in or what place we're in. Especially today, for example, Srila Prabhupada wrote these wonderful books, right? They're available anywhere, and those books have his instructions, have his purports. At the same time, yes, in certain situations it does become difficult. And, you know, because of our physical circumstances, wherever, we might not have that. So in that case, we can consult with our senior Vaishnavas, the senior devotees, devotees whom we have trust in, and who we feel properly represent Guru and Krishna, right? So we have, that's why we have the Sadhu Sangha, or the Association of Devotees. And that, thanks to modern technology, right, modern communication, that's available everywhere. You have the telephone, you have email communication, you can travel, visit people, right? So it's not so difficult. There was a time when you might have to take a 1,000-mile journey, you know, on foot to the Himalayas and go find someone, and, you know. it was much more difficult, but... Yes. Yes, exactly. That's the purpose of Sadhu Sangha, right? So there's three things: Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. These three things combined give us direction on the spiritual path. Guru is the spiritual master. Sadhu is the company of saintly persons, especially the senior saintly persons, those who are more advanced than us in spiritual life. Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra, or scripture. Of these three, Shastra is the basis. That's the fundament. Right? If the Guru goes against Shastra, then the Guru should be rejected. If Sadhus go against Shastra, then they're not Sadhus. Right? But at the same time, that Shastra is understood through the medium of the Guru. Right? So it's a reciprocal process. It's a mutually strengthening process. But Shastra is the fundament, it's the basis. Right? Krishna's own words in Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam.
Yeah, because sometimes we are human beings, we interpret the scripture in our own
tradition.
We may not understand what Prabhupada Ji has written.
Yes.
We just take it literally.
Yeah.
So in that picture, I think we need satsang.
The guided. Srila Prabhupada, he says, he was saying, we listened to a tape this morning, and he was saying how. He says, everyone, they've decided to present their own theories, their own ideas through the Bhagavad Gita. Right? Every philosophy in the world, any person who has some philosophy, writes a commentary on Bhagavad Gita and presents it in the name of Krishna. And Prabhupada says, why do you do that? If no one is stopping you from presenting your own philosophy, if you like, you can write a book, present your own philosophy, become famous as a philosopher, and promote your thing, and you'll find followers, right? That's no problem. Do it if you like. But why do you take the words of Krishna and malinterpret them, right? Interpret them to suit your own needs. Right? Leave Krishna's words alone. If you can follow Krishna's words, if you value Krishna's words, then follow them, then accept them, right? But if you cannot, then don't try to twist them to suit your own needs, to suit your own desires. Right? This is why Srila Prabhupada, he wrote Bhagavad Gita as it is. Right? This is the point. Don't deviate from. Krishna says, Sarva Dharman Paritya Mamekam Sharan, surrender to me. Why do you say, you know, surrender to the impersonal behind Krishna, you know, surrender? Well, why do you say stuff like that? Right? It's just very clear what Krishna is saying. Very, very good. Okay, so let's head back to the text under discussion. So, knowledge and the mode of ignorance, right? Hopefully that's a little clear. Let's move up the ladder now to knowledge and the mode of passion. Text number 21. Let's read the translation and purport again. That knowledge by which one sees that in every different body there's a different type of living entity, you should understand to be in the mode of passion. The concept that the material body is the living entity and that with the destruction of the body the consciousness is also destroyed is called knowledge in the mode of passion. According to that knowledge, bodies differ from one another because of the development of different types of consciousness. Otherwise, there is no separate soul which manifests consciousness. The body is itself the soul, and there is no separate soul beyond the body. According to such knowledge, consciousness is temporary. Or else, there are no individual souls, but there is an all-pervading soul which is full of knowledge, and this body is a manifestation of temporary ignorance. Or beyond this body, There is no special individual or supreme soul. All such conceptions are considered products of the mode of passion. So the quality of the knowledge of quality of knowledge in the mode of passion, right, is that it confuses the body for the self. So mode of ignorance is you're completely absorbed in satisfying the body. You're completely absorbed in, Krishna says, one type of work. Right? You've got certain thing you do, and this is your world, and you cannot see beyond that world. It's knowledge in the mode of ignorance is extremely narrow-minded, very, very a narrow vision. Right? You see, I need this for my satisfaction. It doesn't matter what happens to anyone else. We can have this kind of knowledge as a nation as well, as countries display this kind of knowledge. Right? This is what's good for me. I got to defend my borders, my country, my people's food, my people's housing, my people's this. What happens to the rest of the world, it doesn't matter. Right? Narrow vision, limited vision, this is how far it goes. In the mode of passion, it's a little broader. You see all living entities, but you confuse their bodies for the selves, right? You see, your knowledge is based on differences, right? Someone's white, someone's black, someone's brown, someone's yellow, someone's wearing this type of shirt, someone's wearing this type of shirt, someone's rich, someone's poor, someone's old, someone's young, right? It's all valid knowledge in some sense, meaning you're noting characteristics and you have information, right? But it's knowledge that's founded on the body only. That the self is the body. It's kind of, you can see that knowledge in the mode of passion can very easily lead to knowledge in the mode of ignorance. Right? If you're confusing the self for the body, then it's not too far of a step to then move on to say, okay, to satisfy the needs of the body is my ultimate goal. It's kind of very, it's not a very big step to take. So, most people kind of hover somewhere in mode of passion, knowledge in the mode of passion, knowledge in the mode of ignorance. This is the conception of the vast majority of people today, right? Is confusion of the mode of passion, of the self for the body. This is what modern science teaches us also, right? Certain aspects, hardcore aspects of modern science. We are a bag of chemicals. At the end of this life, the bag of chemicals is mixed in with the general chemicals, and that's it. Right? There's nothing more to achieve. Consciousness, what is consciousness according to mechanistic, materialistic science? What is consciousness? What is it that we call consciousness?
Synaptic processes that are embedded in our senses to determine what we
need. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Consciousness is simply, we have different thoughts which can be pinpointed as these neurons firing through different synapses, connections in the brain. And we have a whole series of connections in the brain. When these connections get complicated enough, they produce a special phenomenon known as consciousness. Right? This is basically the general theory. It sounds a bit simplistic, but it's really the way it is. Right? No one exactly knows. Every scientist today will agree that consciousness is kind of the last frontier for science. We haven't still figured out exactly what it is, but we do know that if things get complicated enough in the brain, it produces consciousness. So the hope is that if we can make computers more and more and more and more complicated, right, then one day one of the computers will walk off and say, hey, I'm not a computer, I'm a person. I have my rights too. And we'll produce life, right? We'll produce human beings, we'll produce consciousness. Right? This is a whole area of research called artificial intelligence. And there's two versions. This is from my brother. He's studying science and religion. So he informs me that there's two versions of artificial intelligence. Weak AI, or artificial intelligence, and strong artificial intelligence. Strong artificial intelligence says basically what we've been saying. Everything about human consciousness can be replicated by computers. Right? Human consciousness or the mind is nothing more than the physical processes of the brain. Right? What's in here? That's consciousness. Weak AI, weak artificial intelligence, says these processes they work through the brain, right? But the actual phenomenon of consciousness is something beyond that. So we can simulate the human intelligence by a computer, but we cannot replicate it. Right? We cannot produce consciousness. We can only produce something that behaves like consciousness. For example, if you have a machine, right, it's relatively easy to produce a machine, a little thing which whenever it sees a red light, right, it will either say or print out a little piece of paper which says, "I see a red light. I see a red light." And it's not too difficult to a sensor, a photo sensor, and you put a filter on it so that it only allows in red light. Right? So that when red light comes and hits the filter, it activates the sensor. The photo sensor produces electricity, and then either the machine says or it prints out a little statement which says, "I see a red light." Right? So anytime you take this machine into a room and you show it a red light, then it'll say, "I see a red light." Now, how many of us would believe that the machine actually sees a red light? Very few of us would. Very, very few. Even those who accept strong art of AI, right, that strong version of it, wouldn't accept it, right? Because it's simply a programmed reaction. Basically, computers are all about syntax, right? They have very little about semantics. They don't understand things. They don't understand meaning. It's all about syntax, about language. So no one would say that the machine actually sees a red light. Now the question is, okay, can you get this complicated enough, simulated enough, where at some point the machine actually starts actually to see the red light, right? Can you build that machine in enough of a complicated way, right, that it actually starts to see the red light? Ian? This is the question. Right? This is the question. According to Krishna and Bhagavad Gita, no. Right? No, absolutely not. Why? Because the principle of consciousness is something very, very different than material substance, than matter. Right? Krishna says very clearly in Bhagavad Gita that these two things are different. Avinashi tu tad vidhi yena sarvam idam datam vinasham aprameyasya. That avinashi tu tad vidhi yena sarvam idam tatam. That which pervades the entire body. You should know. Yam hina vyathayante te purusham purusharshava. No, not that one. I'm thinking wrong one. Anyway, you should know it to be unchanging, eternal. And that which the body it's inhabiting is destructible. The soul is passing through these different changes of body. Dehinosmin yathade. So Krishna makes a very clear distinction between the two. He says, no matter how complicated you get things, you will never be able to produce the living entity, the living force. Right? The basic principle being, the basic mantra, life comes from life. We have no instance of life coming from matter. Life is always produced from life itself. So now you could say, well, okay, but what about this, right? These days we can do brain scans. And we can see where different functions of the brain occur, different functions of the mind. If you are feeling love for someone, we know exactly where the neurons are firing in your brain. When you're angry at someone, when you're reading, when you're playing music, we know the different places in the brain where the neurons are firing. In fact, when you're thinking of God, we know the spot in the brain where religion is located. And all we got to do is disable that spot, you know, and suddenly you lose that ability. If we disable the spot where you think of God, then you don't think of God anymore. Right? Or if we overstimulate it, suddenly you start getting visions and revelations of God, right? Or you start, you know, hearing beautiful music if we stimulate that part, whatever, you know. So we can control it. And you see very clearly that people who lose a certain part of the brain, their motor functions or their speech functions or whatever that might be, are limited. Right? So there is proof that the mind is the brain, right? The mind is what's in here, the gray matter. Yeah, Srinivas? So, but there, okay, there it is, you know, you've got, even with the yantras, right, it's still a physical thing, physical object you're talking about, physical shape, right? Now, if I can control what your thoughts are and I can stimulate them or disable them using the brain, then isn't that proof that the mind is the brain, right? How can you say that the mind is different from the brain then, right? What explanation can you give? Anyone have a defense or an explanation?
I was thinking of people who are actually comatose, and the functions of the brain have actually been shut down.
Right.
And then somehow they revive from the comatose situation, and then they start recalling various different activities and conversations they heard with the doctors in the room, and so on. So based on that, they have an explanation as to how a person could remember. Sometimes you like to say the person was they imagined it or somehow, but even if they imagined it, they would also show that there's activity in the brain, right? Which they in fact deduce that the brain is dead,
right.
It's functioning in the head. So it really blows the heart away.
Right. So there's evidence of that nature, right? Out of body experiences, near death experiences. Of course, not everyone will accept this, but there's pretty fairly well documented, rigorously studied scientific evidence. There are cases that happen on a fairly regular basis, not too many, but they happen regularly, of individuals who have that kind of experience, right? Who are supposed to be physically brain dead, you know, just not working. And yet who can recall things and understand things that they weren't supposed to have, you know, at least not seen. You know, they can recall the scene, but definitely your eyes aren't working. Yeah. Huh? Okay. Just see, it cuts down to the chase, right? There's no beating around the bush. Because the reason part is because unless we first of all understand who we are, right, and we're able to understand the difference between the body and the self, we won't be able to engage in service to Krishna. We won't be able to understand who Krishna is, right? Until we're confusing ourselves as the material body. Right. We don't even understand what spirit is. We have to understand what the nature of spirit is itself. And how can we understand the Supreme Spirit? How can we understand God? Right. So what we're doing now is trying to understand Krishna is trying to understand the whole ocean. Right. But a way to begin understanding the whole ocean is you can take one drop of the ocean. To study the whole ocean is a big task. Right. Some scientists do it. They dive into the ocean. They figure everything out. But a good way to start is you take a few drops of the ocean and you bring it to your little chemistry lab and you see, okay, what content of salt does this have? What microbes is it? What plankton does it have? You know, you study the one drop of water and you get some idea of what the ocean is like, right? You study a little part of it, a little sample of it. So this is what we're kind of doing. We're kind of like little drops of the ocean. We're little samples of God. So if we first understand who we are, our spirit, we study that sample, then we can get some idea who Krishna is. So the idea is we work our way to knowledge of Krishna. Okay? That makes sense? Kind of, we're building our way up. See, there's two ways of knowing things. Right? You can understand what something is, and you can understand what something is not. Right? Both ways are important. If someone were to ask you, what's an orange? Of course, the orange is there. But you can also say, okay, this is not an orange. You've got a table full of fruits, right? This is not an orange. This is an apple. This is not an orange. It's a kiwi. This is not an orange. This is an avocado. This is the orange, right? So both processes work very well. So in the beginning, we're starting off with the negative approach. This is not what it is. Right? And this way, we kind of peel away the extra stuff, and we can see what we're left with. In the end, what we'll be left with is Krishna, okay? So we're working our way up, mode of ignorance, mode of passion, and we're going to get to the mode of goodness soon. Okay. And then Krishna will show up after that. That's a good reminder to keep on moving. Just to answer the question I raised, that argument can be answered in a very simple way. Right? The reason most of us have a difficult time thinking when our brain is not functioning properly or some part of it is disabled or overstimulated or whatever. Yeah, the analogy can be given simply of just like a man working with his computer. Right? There's a person behind the hardware, the software, the apparatus, working and doing so many things with the computer. Now, if the computer crashes, right, what happens to the person? He loses his ability to perform his functions. Right? He's can't do anything. You call these call centers and say, sorry, our system is down. Can you call back a little later? Right. Why can't the person help us? You think, well, you're a person. Can't you help me? Well, because the machinery I'm using, the hardware I'm using, the apparatus I'm using to work is down. Right? So it's like that with the mind and the brain. The brain is like the computer. It's like the hardware. It's like the operating system, you can say. Right? And we, the self, are the user. And when that computer system goes down, then the user has a big problem, right? You can't do it. Or same thing with the car and the driver. When the car is not functioning, then you have a difficult time going places. You think, well, is it the car that goes or you that go? So it's me, but I can't go unless the car goes, right? I can't walk there. So it's like that. The mind will not function if its machinery is not functioning. Some cases it does, right? Some cases you can walk to Albertsons or something. But in general, for most people, if the brain is stuck, then it's not working properly. Right? So in that way, that's the relationship, is hardware and user, between the mind and the brain. Right? So it's not, yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Right. Yeah. In Sanskrit, the word for heart and the word for mind is the same. Is interchangeable. Chitta can mean both heart and mind, and also consciousness. Right. So this is generally considered somehow. You know, we associate the physical location of the mind to be here, but you see, the mind is. It's not a physical object, right? It's a material object. It's not a spiritual object, right? But it's a subtle material object. It's not a gross physical one. So, excuse me, it's nearly impossible to spatially locate it, to physically locate it, right? But according to the Vedic system, this is where the mind is spatially located, right? Whereas we tend to assume that it's up here. You can see that with your body language, right? Hanuman Swami demonstrates it, right? I've been thinking, right? We say, I've been thinking. Right? Why do we point here? Right? I've been thinking. Right? So, but we associate the emotions with here. But according to the Vedas, all the subtle functions happen down here. I've been thinking. Thank you. Like when you're thanking someone, more kind of an exchange, you say, thank you. You don't go, thank you. Okay. Is that okay? So, mode of ignorance, mode of passion. Now, we're heading where Parth wants us to go. Mode of goodness. Let's read the verse and the purport to that. Text 20. That knowledge by which one undivided spiritual nature is seen in all living entities, though they are divided into innumerable forms, you should understand to be in the mode of goodness. Purport. A person who sees one spirit soul in every living being, whether a demigod, human being, animal, bird, beast, aquatic, or plant, possesses knowledge in the mode of goodness. In all living entities, one spirit soul is there, although they have different bodies in terms of their previous work. As described in the 7th chapter, the manifestation of the living force in every body is due to the superior nature of the Supreme Lord. Thus, to see that one superior nature, that living force in every body, is to see in the mode of goodness. That living energy is imperishable, although the bodies are perishable. Differences are perceived in terms of the body. Because there are many forms of material existence in conditioned life, the living force appears to be divided. Such impersonal knowledge is an aspect of self-realization. So here we find it. As the knowledge progresses, the mind becomes more and more broad. It expands. Mahatma, as we were saying in the very beginning of this class. You become large-minded, broad-minded. Whereas in the mode of passion, you saw everyone in terms of the differences of their body. In the mode of goodness, you see the unity of all beings. Why? Because you're able to transcend the level of the body and see the spirit soul within every living entity. And that spirit soul is equal in every living entity. Right? There's no differences in terms of one's bigger, one's smaller. All the different labels we put on ourselves, man, woman, white, black, Hindu, Muslim, Christian, big, tall, fat, thin, ugly, handsome, all these different labels that we put on the body, they don't apply to the spirit soul. They only relate to the physical body. So one who's able to move beyond these, they're called upadhis in Sanskrit. Upadhis means labels or designations, limitations. One who's able to move beyond these limitations and look at the self within each living entity, that person is said to have knowledge in the mode of goodness. Krishna says earlier in Bhagavad Gita, he says, Vidya vinaya sampanne brahmane gavihastini shuni chaiva shvapakecha pandita samadarshinaha. The pandita, or the one who possesses actual knowledge, same point he's making again. He says, that person, samadarshana, he sees with equal vision, vidya vinaya sampane brahmane, a pure and gentle brahmana, brahmane gavi, an elephant, gavi, cow, hastini, elephant, shuni, a dog, and shvapake, a low-class person, a person who's truly in knowledge, who's in the mode of goodness, right? Sees all of these individuals with equal vision. So everyone today, we're looking for equality, we're looking for peace, right? This is kind of a universal human value in our Bill of Rights, right? Each person is created equal and has the right to life, liberty, and happiness, right? So we're all looking for this, and we have January 16th is Martin Luther King Jr. Human Rights Day, right? So, people fight for human rights. There's different organizations that work for it. And we're looking for equality. All human beings are equal. No racial discrimination. No discrimination based on sex and based on your age. And it's illegal to discriminate by all these things. Right? So we're endeavoring for this kind of equality. But Srila Prabhupada would say repeatedly that that kind of equality or that kind of unity cannot be achieved if our vision is restricted to the body. Right? If we think that we can find that unity based on the body itself, then we'll be frustrated. The United Nations, for example, Srila Prabhupada would always give that example. He says, we're looking for unity in the United Nations, but why is it that the number of flags outside the United Nations building in New York keeps increasing? Right? People divide, naturally based on the body. You see this any part in the world, any place in the world where there's any kind of difference, a different ethnic group, a different language group, a different religious group, and people will want to be separate, want independence. This is natural in the material world, based on the body, because everyone's vision is restricted on the physical, on the material body. This is who we are. If we want that true equality, then we have to move beyond the level of the body to the level of the spirit soul. That's where true equality can be found. Because the spirit soul has no upadhis, no designations, no labels, no limitations, no thing you can put on the soul, no label, except for one. And what is that? What is that designation you can put on the soul? Even karma is destroyed, it goes away, it doesn't stick to the soul, it's not part of who the soul actually is. There's only one thing you can say on the soul, a label you can apply. Right? This soul is? Yeah, but those are, yes, that's true. But those are the negative things. It's not this, not this, not this. What's the one positive label you can put on the soul?
Huh?
Yes, it's eternal. Okay, so we've got qualities. Yeah, the only positive, real positive label you can put on is Jivera Swarupoi Krishnera Nityadas. This living entity is Krishna Nityadas, is the eternal servant of God. Right? Eternal servant of Krishna. Their spirit soul is related to the ultimate supreme spirit. This individual spirit is related to the supreme. That's its relationship with the supreme spirit is the only positive label you can put on the self. Right? The soul has many qualities, of course, but the only kind of designation you can say, you know, who does he belong to, right, is Krishna Nityadas. He's Krishna Das, servant of Krishna. This is why when we get Diksha, right, then the spiritual master will change our name and give us a spiritual name, a Krishna conscious name. What's the point of that? It's just to remind ourselves and those who call to us that this person is, we understand, we're not the material body, we're not the physical senses, right? We are servant of Krishna. Radhika Raman Das. What does that mean? I'm a servant of Krishna. To remind myself, okay, this is who I am. Let me not confuse myself with this material body. Let me not confuse Srinivas with, you know, some Indian from South India. Right? No, that's not who he is. He is Srinivas Das, right? Servant of Lord Krishna, servant of the Lord. This is who he is. So this is the knowledge and the mode of goodness, right? It sees everyone with a vision of equality. Now the interesting thing is, it's kind of the flip side of the mode of ignorance. The mode of ignorance was also some kind of a universal vision, in that Krishna used similar words. He says, "Kritsnavad ekasmin." He says, "One who sees one thing as everything has knowledge in the mode of ignorance." Knowledge in the mode of goodness is one who sees everything as one. Right? You see the opposite, the difference? One who takes his little life and says, this, my body, my senses, my this, my that, right? This is everything. This is all that matters. This is the whole world. Right? Mode of ignorance. Someone who says, everything there is, I can see. This is all united. This is one. Right? That's knowledge in the mode of goodness. Yeah.
Saying about equality, so it's like I think this state is a very advanced one, and we as ordinary people cannot see that.
Mm-hmm.
Or like when it comes to equality, for example, a person who is drunk and a very big intellectual, they cannot be equal.
Okay.
So I guess the main point to see is that the soul in everyone is the same, but really, I mean, that, I mean, by the behavior, they're not equal.
Yeah, so that's a very good question, because it's a practical question. You say, okay, we have this kind of unified vision as the goal, but is it at all practical? Can we actually put this into practice beyond our, sessions in the temple, you know, where we all feel we're all equal? But in the real world, how does this actually work? It's a very good question, and Srila Prabhupada, he addresses this question in particular. He says, seeing everyone with equal vision does not mean that you behave with everyone in exactly the same way. Right? So he says, to show an animal, for example, compassion, the way you behave with an animal and the way you behave with a human being. Now, according to Vedic vision, according to the vision of the mode of goodness, an animal and a human being are exactly the same when it comes to their spiritual identity, who they are. Right? every life force, even a plant, is animal, insect, everything, right? But the way you behave with it is not the same way. Right? So suppose he says, for example, a tiger. You meet a tiger, right? And you think, I'm a Krishna conscious person. I see everyone equally. Let me show compassion unto this animal. Right? The quality of a devotee is to show compassion. Right? How do you show compassion to the tiger? You don't go up and hug the tiger like you would your child or your mother or your father, whatever. You know, you don't do that. That's foolishness. Because the tiger's body is different. The tiger's nature is different. Right? If you want to show compassion to a dog, he says, or a cat, it's best not to put it in bed with you, right? And to live with it like that. He says, no, this is not what the body of a dog is meant to, how it's meant to interact with a human being. Right? Feed it some prasadam. Give it some protection. Right? Give it a nice home to live in. Leave it outside so it can protect your house. Right? That's how you show compassion to an animal, is by feeding its prasadam, helping it reach a human birth. Right? If you meet a drunk on the street, how do you show compassion to a drunk? You see everyone equally. But just like you invite your friends into your house, it's not expected that you invite a drunk into your house. Right? That's not wisdom, right? That's foolishness. Point is, how do you help him? Well, try to help him get out of that condition. Right? Yeah?
Can you give us a specific example of a drunk?
A specific example.
Oh.
Right, what, Jagai Mother? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. Very good. Oh, beautiful, beautiful. It just hits the nail on the head, right? So, New Year's Eve, a few of us went on Harinam. We chanting Hare Krishna, downtown Boise. And New Year's Eve is, of course, a wonderful time for drunks. the number of drunks increases extraordinarily. We met one individual. We were chanting, and he came up. And he was not your average drunk. He wasn't, you know, a perpetual drunk. He seemed heavily drunk, but he was fairly well-dressed, you know, decent, you know. And he came out and, you know, and he kind of stands and looks at us chanting. And then he opens up his wallet with great, you know, drama, the way drunks do, you know. And then pulls his finger in, pulls out a $5 bill, hands it to us. And Chandraprabhu immediately accepts and says, thank you very much for the donation. And then this is just near the end of our Harinam. We're heading home, right? So we're merrily going on to where our car is parked. And, of course, the drunk is following us. And he says, I'll go with you. And we say, well, actually, our music's ending now. We're going home. He says, I'll go with you there. Well, same point, right? It's not exactly how you show compassion to a drunk, is by allowing him to follow you home, right? So, what do we do? Well, Chandraprabhu, he decides to show compassion on the drunk. And he begins talking to him and saying, yes, you can come with us home, right? We have a temple. It's a very wonderful place. Come there, but in the morning. Come in the morning. He says, okay, tell me where you live. And he says, well, I'll give you a card. Let me see if I have a card. Just as it so happens, Srinivas is there. And without even hearing Chandraprabhu, he thinks, well, we should give this drunk some compassion, right? So he looks through his wallet and pulls out a card for the temple and hands it to the drunk, who is very happy. And Chandraprabhu says, well, turn it over and see this mantra on the back. Chant this mantra and it'll relieve you of your miseries. The drunk, he says, you know, I'm so sad. You don't know how sad I am. Because he's like I said, he's not an ordinary drunk. Right? He's not happy on New Year's Eve. He's saying, you don't know the suffering I've been through. And I really need some relief. And Chandraprabhu says, you just chant these names of God, right? And you will find unlimited spiritual relief. And he makes him repeat every word of the Maha Mantra behind it. He explains what it means, requests him to chant. And at that point, the drunk actually is satisfied, right? Somewhere through all that mode of ignorance, the holy names of the Lord is still able to penetrate, and it makes a little bit of sense to him, you know? And he says, okay, that's okay, you know? Maybe I'll see you guys later. And he heads in the other direction. He doesn't follow us home anymore. It kind of sinks in, the whole thing, right? So that's how you show compassion. That was seeing, Chandraprabhu was seeing the drunk equally, right, with equal vision. But whereas we might have actually invited someone to the temple who was a little bit more sober, we did not want to do that with the drunk, right? But at the same time, because we think, okay, he's still Krishna Das, he's a servant of Krishna, ultimately, he's a spirit soul, let me try to get him back home. Right? Let me try to get him back to the lotus feet of Krishna. That will be his satisfaction. Ian? Huh? He hasn't come. There was a couple other people, at least one other person, who did come on New Year's Day from our Haina. He wasn't so drunk. But you never know with these things, you know. There are stories of people keeping mantra cards for years and then finding them somewhere and chanting and changing their life. You know, there are very, very real stories of such things happening. So you never know. And even if he doesn't, right, that much little progress he's made in his life back to Krishna. Little bit of, he's worked his way from the mode of ignorance where he was. You know, this will help him, some sliver of the mode of goodness, and you could see a little bit of relief on his face. This is the quality of the holy name we were saying, right? Cheto darpanam arjanam bhavamaha davagni nirvapanam. The holy name, first thing it does, bhavamaha davagni nirvapanam. It completely, well, second thing, it completely destroys the miseries of material existence, and you could see on his face some relief as soon as he came in contact with the holy name. Something went in his, from his miserable condition, a little bit of relief was felt. Right? That's simply because of coming in contact with Krishna. So that's kind of a practical example.
Basically, ultimately, you see everybody else.
Yes, see, this is the point. This vision of equality, it cannot actually be practically applied if it's impersonal. If we think that this oneness of all beings is some kind of a, you know, energy, and we're all one because we're all one big soul, right? It has no practical application. Right? What are you going to do? Just kind of, you know, just, you know, go around hugging everyone, or, you know, it's like, how are you going to actually practically apply that? No, the only practical application comes when you see, no, that level. The point is, because he's a spirit soul, his identity is Krishna Das or Krishna Dasi, servant of Krishna. So let me connect this person with Krishna. That's when you can actually live on the platform of equality. This is why simply the platform of jnana or knowledge of everyone's equality cannot last. It's not a position of activity. You cannot last there very long. You have some kind of a vision, but it doesn't last. In order to actually live there in that platform, you have to come to the point of actually seeing people in relation with Krishna, a personal realization. Yeah.
Question. It's like I have a friend, and when she talks to me, I'm able to read. We say that I'm able to read her mind, what she's going to say. And the same thing with her; she understands what I'm saying. One day she's lying to me. She knows she's lying to me, and I know she's lying to me. So, but like how I have heard this is, you will come to know about this that another person is lying to you because the same God resides in you and her. So how do you explain this? Like, is this the same concept or is it different?
It's possible. The super soul, the Lord in the form of Paramatma, is there in everyone's heart, and he can give us knowledge about where another person is at or what they're thinking, right? But it doesn't have to be that. It means that's a pretty pure and perfected state. It can also simply be on the level of the subtle body, on the level of the mind, intelligence, and ego. There's two bodies, the gross physical body and the subtle body. Right? So the subtle body has its own independent functioning, and it can simply happen through a connection of the subtle body. And in that case, it's simply a material phenomenon. Right? So 90% of the time when that kind of thing happens, it's not likely to be very spiritual. Right?
I meet this person for the first time, and we never had any connection, we didn't know each other, nothing, but still I'm able to judge what that person is up to.
Even that can be on the level of the subtle body, the subtle mind. The mind is a very, very powerful entity, and it can do amazing things, you know. Some people have that kind of power, clairvoyance and things like that. It happens sometimes. Even great yogis have that power of reading people's minds. It doesn't have to be a spiritual thing. The way you know it's a spiritual thing is when Krishna's involved, when God's involved, right? That's when you know. Yeah.
Can you give us an example of like a time when super soul and Krishna?
Yes, yes, very much so. When someone is when you're on book distribution, for example, right? You're giving someone a book about Krishna. You're introducing, you're telling them about Krishna for the first time. Something in that person is attracted to Krishna, to the book. Despite his conditioning in the mode of ignorance, despite his conditioning in the mode, despite the pulls in different directions, right? At that point you know that it's the super soul speaking within the heart, saying, take this book, go, look into this. Right? When experienced devotees, for example, Ganapati Swami and other devotees also, they describe their experience of how they're able to see that someone is ready for Krishna consciousness. This person looks like a prime candidate. And you just somehow understand this fact. This person is ready to surrender to Krishna. You can see there's something there, right? This is the super soul speaking from within, encouraging you and encouraging the person. Come, meet up, and learn about Krishna like that. This is especially the case in relationships between the spiritual master and disciple. The spiritual master, when the spiritual master understands or speaks or gives advice to his disciple, it's through the inspiration of the super soul within the heart. Right? That's not knowledge coming from any material means. It says, Divya Gyan Hriday Prakashito, we sing every morning. That knowledge is divine knowledge, Divya Gyan, revealed from within the heart, through the super soul. Because the super soul within the heart, the Chaitya Guru, is externally manifested in the form of the spiritual master. So they're actually different manifestations. The spiritual master outside is a representative or manifestation of the Lord within the heart. So when the spiritual master says something, so often devotees have this experience. The spiritual master, or not even just the spiritual master, but any pure devotee, will say something and it'll hit to the core of the heart. It'll just like that. So many people had experience with Srila Prabhupada like that. He'd just look at someone and they felt that his glance went right through them. It just cut through all their ignorance and hit the core of their heart. And they come away feeling, my God, what's the purpose of my life? Why am I doing this? You know, where do I find meaning? You know, think about Krishna. They just come out with some kind of, you know, epiphany. And all Srila Prabhupada did was look at them. You know? It's because it's the super soul acting within the heart. Right? Srila Prabhupada never says, I know everything, I'm all knowing, I know you might. No. But Krishna within the heart, he's saying, go, surrender, surrender. Time has come. You can do it. He's pushing. Because Krishna wants us back, right? He's pushing. Come, come, go. So that's when we know the super soul is involved. Other cases, he might be, might not be. Right? Usually it's our own mind playing games, you know. It's our own mind showing itself off or doing something extraordinary.
Well, as you're saying, so if your mind is saying something, do this, and you should not accept that as what Krishna is saying, you should accept that you think that you just surrender and learn what the people are saying, or the spiritual master and the others are saying, this is that, and you surrender.
If the mind is saying, you mean, as opposed to what the mind is saying?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, see, the thing is, what our mind is saying, we have to corroborate with the instructions of Guru and the instructions of Krishna. Right? We cannot trust our mind until the mind is impure. Right? Until we're purified, we cannot trust what the mind says. Because the mind is very cunning. But the process is, until the mind is purified, we corroborate the mind, the mind's demands, by this, the instructions of Guru and Krishna. If what our mind is saying is confirmed by the instructions of Guru and Krishna, then we can say, okay, that was okay. Right? But it's a process of strengthening. We strengthen the intelligence, we strengthen the mind. When we become in a purified condition, then yes, our thoughts and feelings are naturally connected with Krishna. That's true. But in the beginning, it's very dangerous to trust the mind only.
How do you, at what point of time you say that, okay, this person is purified, okay, I'm purified.
When all that person's thoughts and activities, his mind, his mental thoughts, they are completely in flow with Krishna's. When a person's desires are in sync with Krishna's desires, then that person is a jivan mukta. He's liberated even within this life.
So that means, again, the other thing is, again, it's like we can identify this that my desires are same as Krishna's desires, because we can kind of testify that with the Shastra, and we can, from our what
Shastra
are
and Guru.
Guru, right.
Yes, by that, exactly. Okay, so now last point. The mode of goodness is the point of unity. We see everyone as one, right? United. This is the mode of goodness. But we know that even the mode of goodness is a material mode, right? It's still within the material world. In other words, it's still one of the chains that binds us to the material world, right? Krishna tells Arjuna, Nistrai Gunya Bhava Arjuna. O Arjuna, become transcendental to the three modes of material nature. The mode of goodness is good because it's the closest thing to the spiritual platform. It's kind of the springboard from which to get to the spiritual point, to the transcendental point. Right? But what is the transcendental platform? What is transcendental knowledge? At the mode of goodness, you see the unity amongst all beings, the equality. Once you're at that platform of seeing the unity amongst all living entities, after that, and you see, unity means seeing everyone is related to Krishna, Krishna Das. After that, then you can begin developing a relationship with Krishna. And once that relationship with Krishna arises, you start seeing all kinds of differences again. What kind of differences do you see? These are differences not based on the body. These are differences not based on power or prestige or fame or anything like that. These are, you see all kinds of variety in the spiritual world. You see that every individual has a separate, individual, unique, distinct relationship with Krishna. Right? Every person is a unique individual who is personally related to Krishna. In other words, at the transcendental platform, it is not true that all differences get washed out. In order to come to the transcendental platform, you have to first get rid of all differences. Why? Because right now, our differences are based on the body. But once you're done with the differences of the body, and you come to the point of spirit, then you can see differences based on the spirit soul, on the platform of the spirit. Right? Those are spiritual differences. And those depend upon our relationship with Krishna. Relationship. So every individual, every person, each one of us has a distinct and unique relationship with Krishna in the spiritual world. And we find this in Srimad Bhagavatam, we find this in all the pastimes, activities of Krishna in the scriptures, right? How Krishna is relating to each individual in a very personal and a very unique way. Because in the end, we're not all one. Right? In the final matter, we're not all one. For each individual. Krishna says, Mamai Vangshu Jiva Loke Jiva Bhuta Sanatana. Every living entity is my ansha, is my part, and is sanatana, is eternal. Right? So we are eternally individual, but our differences are not based on the body, they're based on our relationship with Krishna. So one final example of this. When Lord Krishna left Vrindavana to kill Kansa in Mathura. Right? At one point, he had to enter Kansa's arena. Kansa had set up a wrestling match for Krishna and Balaram with the greatest wrestlers of his kingdom. And the hope was, in this wrestling match, they'd be killed. And that way, he'd get rid of Krishna. So, wrestling was something that, like today, people love to see, love to watch. So, all the citizens of the city of Mathura were assembled in this great stadium, right, great arena, ready to watch this match. And they had heard that Krishna's, you know, pretty amazing, right? He's killed all these wonderful demons, Dhenukasur, Aghasur, Bakasur, you know, all these powerful guys. Let's see who this person is. Right? So Krishna, he walks into the arena of the wrestling arena. And everyone sees Krishna. But everyone sees Krishna differently. everyone understands, has a different relationship with Krishna, a different mood they exchange with Krishna. The Srimad Bhagavatam in Krishna book, Srila Prabhupada very beautifully describes how each individual sees Krishna. And to end, I'll just read you that verse. Okay, this is from Canto 10, Chapter 43 of Srimad Bhagavatam. Malla nama shanir nirnam naravara stri nam smaro murti man gopanam svajano satam kshiti bhujam shasta svapitro shishu mrityur bhoja patir virada bhutusham tattvam param yoginam vrishni nam paradevateti vidito rangam gata sagraja. The various groups of people in the arena regarded Krishna in different ways when he entered it with his elder brother. Okay, so what were the different groups of people there? There were the wrestlers who were due to fight with Krishna, the men in the assembly, the men of Mathura, the women, the cowherd men, the cowherd boys who had accompanied Krishna from Vrindavan, right, the people, the village people of Vrindavan, the kshatriyas or the rulers there, in the assembly, Kansa's assembly, Krishna's parents, right? Bhagavatam says, Nanda and Yashoda were there. Devaki Vasudeva were still in prison. And Kansa. Kansa, the unintelligent, is another category, the foolish, avidusham. And there were some yogis or self-realized souls there who had come to see Krishna. So these are the different categories. How do they see Krishna? So let's see if we can guess. We can try. Let's try an easy one. How did Krishna's parents see him? As their most beloved child. Right? This is all they saw. They didn't see God is here. Right? Their loving child. Their relationship with Krishna is vatsalya, that of parental affection. And their biggest concern, of course, was Krishna's such a small boy. He's only, you know what, 12, 13 years old. How can he fight with these huge muscled wrestlemen? You know, how can he do that? I'm sure this is so unfair, you know, this is terrible. It's just so concerned, frightened for Krishna. What's going to happen to him? The cowherd men, also not too difficult, who had accompanied him from Vrindavan. Friend, it says relative, as someone from his own village, my own person, right? From my own village, I'm from his family, right? Like that. The yogis, what did they see Krishna as? Yeah, teacher, the supreme absolute truth, right? What they're looking for, their aim, there, the absolute truth. Let's say God in those terms, the Lord in the heart, like that. The Rishnis, sorry, there was another category I didn't say. The Rishnis, or the Krishna's larger family, the Yadu dynasty, Krishna's larger family living in Mathura. They saw him as?
Huh?
No, not cowherd boy, because that's from Vrindavan. These are the residents of... As a relative, yes, but a little more. Relatives was specifically given for Vrindavan. It says that they're supremely worshipable deity. He was, in other words, he was the head of their clan, right? Head of their dynasty. Krishna was the supreme amongst them. They were very proud that this is our leader, right? The leader of the Yadu, leader of the Vishnis. Okay. All the men, how did they see him? As the best of males. Right, the supreme, most handsome man, really impressed by his stature, by who he is. The women? Basically, but who did he see him as? Basically, in that mood, right? But it says, as Smaro Murtiman, as Cupid himself, right? As the most beautiful man they could possibly imagine, completely. He stole their hearts. Smaro Murtiman. Cupid himself personified Madana. Krishna is known as Madan Mohan, one who attracts even Cupid. Right? So there it says their lust was incited by Krishna. all the kings there, the impious kings. As the chastiser, as the punisher, someone who had come to deliver them what is due. Right? Every person who does something wrong knows that something is coming to them. Right? They know ultimately something will come back to them. Right? And in Krishna, they saw, okay, it's here. Right? The Supreme is here. So as chastiser. The unintelligent, they saw Krishna as? In those terms, as destroyer, or more broadly, I mean, that's almost right on, is more broadly the universal form, the Virat Rupa, he who encompasses everything, who contains everything, the Supreme. And in that form, Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, as the Virat Rupa, he is Kalosmi Sarvakshaya Krit. He's time himself, the destroyer of everything. So you're right, as the destroyer, as just everything, time in terms of glory, right? In other words, they had very little personal relationship with Krishna, just seeing God in terms of this great force up there, at a distance. No personal, very lack of that. Some fear involved. Most people, the average unintelligent person, fears God, right? That's their relationship. The wrestlers, they saw him as? Yes, exactly. The strongest, the most powerful. It says, like a thunderbolt. They saw Krishna as a thunderbolt. Krishna's yellow clothing, right, is as bright as a thunderbolt. They thought, here he is, and he's going to strike any time. Let's prepare, right, as a thunderbolt. And finally, the king of the Bhojas, Kansa, saw him as death. Right? Kansa has no doubt. Right? The others, the rest of us thought, maybe we can fight this guy. Kamsa had no doubt, my death is here. Right? He had been fearing, freaking out for months now. Right? He had been completely sitting, standing, sleeping, waking, eating, drinking. Constantly, all he could see was Krishna, 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 everywhere. In that way, he was actually Krishna conscious. Right? He was actually Krishna conscious. All he could think of was Krishna everywhere. Why? Because he knew, my death is here, Krishna is death. He was Krishna conscious, but he wouldn't be regarded as a devotee. Why? Because his thinking of Krishna was not favorable. Right? It's a side point. Bhakti has to be, the qualities of bhakti, anukulyena Krishna anushilana. It has to be favorably performed. It has to be positively directed to Krishna. You can think of Krishna negatively. It does make you Krishna conscious in some sense, but you're not a devotee. Right? You have to think of him positively. Anyway, he knew, my death is here. Right? So each person saw Krishna differently. They had a different relationship with Krishna. Of course, Kamsa's was a pretty temporary relationship, you know, death, and he's gone, he's finished. But with the others, you could see, they all had a particular rasa or relationship they exchanged with Krishna. In other words, it wasn't the case that when Krishna arrived, everyone saw a blinding white light and that was it, that was God. Right? This is the point we were making. Mode of goodness means we see the unity in everyone. But on the transcendental platform, we see that even within that unity, even within spiritual life, there's variety, there's difference. And that's when we find a personal relationship with God. We find a personal relationship with Krishna. The ladies had a relationship of Shringara, the cowherd boys of Sakya, of parents of Vatsalya, right? Each person had a particular relationship. And those relationships are eternal, right? That's at the platform of transcendental knowledge, or Divya Jnana. And that's where we're ultimately heading, right? So first, expand our vision, become broader and broader and broader. See, first of all, understand that we're all spirit soul, we're all equal, and then try to cultivate our relationship with Krishna. It's only when we cultivate this relationship with Krishna, and this is kind of the catch, actually. It's only when we cultivate this relationship with Krishna that we can actually, like I was saying to Bhavesh, we can actually maintain this platform of seeing equality. We can see everyone is related to Krishna. We're all equal, we're all brothers, sisters. Why? Because everyone is related to Krishna. Everyone has a relationship with Krishna. This is where, why we're all united. We're one big community. This is the platform of true equality. Yes, he was heading there, kind of came from there, heading there, right? He did receive impersonal liberation when he was killed by Krishna. So he had a past life enmity with Krishna that he was trying to overcome. But he wasn't Jain Vijay, that was a difference.
Or he was not.
No, there was Shishupal and Dantavakta. Yeah.
There's an example given, I think, in Bhagavatam that compared devotee and person like Kamsa as both as Kata in your form.
Yeah.
Krishna is using other form to pick up the one which is in there.
So who's the two thorns in this analogy?
So it's like the devotee that the thorn which is in the hand of Krishna.
Yeah. Okay.
The devotee which is in the leg stuck there is a demon, but he's also thinking about Krishna and
that's
he's saying using the devotee to take out the
Very good. So they both Krishna's using the same function. So for example he uses Jay and Vijay, right? They come in three different births, right? And like saying, he's using that tool to pluck out what's harmful. So you use a thorn to pull out. Very nice analogy. Very good. Okay. Anything else? Okay, it's getting kind of late. It's 9:05. Thank you very much for your attention. Next time, my mother will be giving class. So make sure you come. Jai Srimad Bhagavad Gita ki, Jai Srila Prabhupada ki, Jai.